This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Baraja aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal. Thank you to those of you joining me tonight on Sirius 220, XM 206, as well as to those of you tuning in via our website, horseracingradio.net. Don't forget, you can listen to replays of all of our previous shows on the website as well. Now, a portion of the proceeds from Jock Talk go to benefit the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. Show your support as well by going to pdjf.org. I'm sure many of you saw the Eclipse Awards Saturday night, and what a year we had. The awards night reflected that. Now tonight, I have a guest who was a recipient of an Eclipse Award a few years ago. He was the Eclipse Award winning apprentice jockey in 2011. He's racked up 431 wins and counting, over $9 million in earnings. He's calling us from California. Kyle Frey, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you, Christina?
I'm doing great, Kyle. Really appreciate you joining us tonight and super excited about the show. And just to catch up with you, we rode together a couple years ago back at Parks, where you really made a name for yourself there. And how, looking back, what do you think, looking back on your journey?
It was a lot of fun, that's for sure. Philadelphia was really good to me at that time. And, you know, I've gone back before, and they still, you know, tried to help me as best possible. But Things probably just didn't pan out. But no, I mean, I love Philadelphia, and at that point in my life was one of my peaks. You know, it felt like every day I showed up in the jock room, I was going to win one or two or three.
Hey, that's a good way to do it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now you're enjoying the sunny weather out in California.
Yeah, definitely. I love the seasons, you know, so I try to live somewhere where they only have the good ones.
Well, I can't blame you there. We're getting a blizzard here in a couple of days. But
oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, but you're actually a native of California, Tracy, I believe, yes?
Yes, yes, correct.
Tell me what's in Tracy, California.
Nothing.
Nothing? Well.
just some tiny little small town. I mean, it's expanded since I have, you know, previously lived there. But for the most part, it's not much. I mean, it's about the size of Croydon, you know, in Philadelphia.
Sure.
It's about like that, maybe a little bit more, like Croydon and Bensalem combined. And then there's nothing for about 20 miles.
Wow. Well, one day maybe they'll have a sign there saying the birthplace of Kyle Frey. You never know.
I don't know about that, but yeah, that'd be nice.
So growing up in Tracy, California, where there was not much to do, did you have any siblings growing up?
Yes, I did. I had 3 older brothers and 1 younger sister, and now currently another little brother.
Wow, big family, big family. Did any of your siblings go on to pursue jobs at the racetrack?
No. I'm the only one that was you know, really interested and inspired by horses and horse racing. You know, the rest of the family, they went on and did their own thing. But I was the right size and frame, and I started young. My other siblings, they didn't have the knack for it.
Well, and it's understandable that you got involved because your grandfather, Paul Frey, was a very successful jockey. Tell us about him.
He was a great man, very, very smart and wise. A lot of people said that he had what you call golden hands, where people would offer him hundreds just to get on a horse one time, just to tell him what was wrong with the horse. Everywhere I go, there are older seasoned horse racing people. I don't know what you call it, but they have nothing but a crazy stories about, oh, your grandpa got on this horse one time, he told me bet all my money, da da da. Sure enough, the horse wins by three. He paid like $30. I mean, stuff like that. You know, what the trainers would ask him, what do you think about this horse, or is this horse sore, and if he is, where at? And he could tell him first time getting on the horse. I mean, just phenomenal. That's what they call golden hands.
Wow. Golden hands, indeed. He did win more than 4,000 races, if I'm correct.
Definitely, yeah.
And he actually rode...
He held the record for most wins in a meet at Long Acres in Washington before it had now closed down, which is currently Emerald Downs.
Wow. And he rode in the 1963 Derby as well. So he was not just known there at Long Acres, but nationally as well.
Yes, definitely. I believe he rode On My Honor.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a really nice horse. And then he had another mount that he was supposed to go in with, but the horse had to scratch or something, stepped on a nail or had a temperature. And he was really upset about that because he thought he really had a shot with that horse.
Ah, such are the ups and downs of horse racing. But
you know it.
your father also was involved at the racetrack and is currently, I believe. Tell us about your father.
My father's a valet, he's my valet, he's Russell Bates' valet, and also William Anton Georgie's valet, so it's kind of funny, you know, having your dad working for you. He doesn't really work for you, he's just kind of, he's there, because I can't really tell him, hey, clean my boots or anything.
You can't fire him, right?
I try to, but then I just feel like a jerk afterwards.
Duh. Okay, well, as you should, you shouldn't fire your dad. Come on now.
Yeah. What was that?
I said you can't fire your father.
I've tried plenty of times. No, I'm just kidding.
He was a trainer and an exercise rider as well, yeah?
Yes. He trained, had like 24 head, 25 head, and then just kind of fell out of it. His biggest thing is he said he couldn't tolerate the owners, you know, somebody who knows nothing about horses trying to tell him what he should do and how he should do it. For him, that was like an insult. You know, you're going to bring your horses to me because I know what I'm doing, and then you're going to try and tell me how to do what I know how to do, which I can understand that. You know, I've had moments like that as well with racing horses.
Right. And that is understandable, of course. Now, did your grandfather and your dad, did they approve of your pursuits in becoming a jockey?
When I was younger, my grandfather did not encourage it. He always told me, you know, if you do decide to do it, make sure you go to college first and, you know, get some form of a business degree, because his biggest thing is he made, you know, back in those days would have been considered millions of dollars. And he kind of had his fun, spent a little bit of it, and, you know, he had a little piece left, but not nearly what he should have. So that was his biggest thing, is that I learn how to manage my money or take some kind of business course, which I never got around to, but I try to pay attention to the right people these days, because I definitely blew a small fortune.
Well, and that is one of the tough parts of being a jockey, especially many jockeys who get into the sport are so young. And to be so young and then to all of a sudden make large sums of money and not consistently. Riders obviously are contracted employees, and they only make, of course, good money when they're winning. So it has to be difficult to know how to properly manage your money.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, one day chicken, next day feathers.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
You winning Yeah, you can be making a bunch of money one day. Just like you said, though, it's on and off. But, I mean, for me, for the most part, you remember pretty well. You know, as a bug, when I had the bug, I was winning. You know, it was very consistent for me. I mean, it was very much so a blessing, especially being at parks where the purses are, you know, immense. you remember that.
Right. Oh,
so I was doing pretty good. My biggest downfall, I think, was when I broke my leg. You know, I broke my femur. I had that horse go down. And then I was out for like 3 months. And then I started riding again back home. And then when I tried to go back to Philadelphia, there was a few people that were upset with me for not coming back sooner. So I just didn't get the horses that they were once giving me.
Right, again,
they had felt that I should have come back right away. You know, but hey, that's horse racing. People are entitled to feel a certain way in this life.
Of course, the ups and downs of horse racing, again, we're talking about. Now, your grandfather, he told you to learn how to manage your money, but what other advice did he give you as far as actually riding, as far as perfecting your style? Did he give you advice according to that?
Butt down, mouth shut. That was the biggest thing.
Keep your mouth shut.
You know, he'd always say, he'd give me a little tips here and there and stuff. But he was a lot older, and also he went blind towards the end of his life. So it's not like he could get on a horse and show me, which would have been amazing. I would have loved that. But he always told me stories, you know, just crazy stories. And he gave me a lot of tips. You know, heels down. If a horse starts running off with you, instead of standing up and skiing on him, you know, just sit back and put your feet in front of you and, you know, try to stay low, because then you're just going to be fighting the horse and going to be hitting all over himself and getting tired and stuff. So a lot of stuff like that. A lot of good tips.
And you were surrounded by horses, of course, pretty much your entire life, and you did ride when you were very young. Is that right?
Yeah, no, I probably rode before I walked.
Wow.
My dad would always put me on the backs of ponies and stuff like that on the backside. And then I believe right about when I was 7 or 8 or so, my dad got me a horse off of a trainer named Jed Josephson for $1, just, you know, whatever purpose.
$1.
And, the retired horse, Lucky Treaton is his name. And I was like my best friend for years, but came to a point where it was getting hard for us to afford it, so we had to get rid of him. And that's when I kind of fell out of horses for a few years, and then came back to it about, I want to say, 16, on and off. Then really just committed when I was about 17. Dropped out of school and everything.
Hey, it worked out well for you. And
oh, yeah, definitely.
You actually spent some time learning how to jump.
Yeah, and I guess I came back about 14 for the summer. During the summertime, I'd come live with stay with my dad and his girlfriend at the time, who was a hunter jumper instructor. She was teaching me how to do all that, which really helped me get balance and, you know, a technical style of riding. You know, some of these cowboy guys, they just come in and get to scooting and booting on them. That English is more of a, you know, a technical style, I feel. But there's every style has its strong points.
Right. And I can certainly see where that would help you when preparing for the racetrack. And when you were 16, you went to work horses on a ranch. Is that right?
I went to work on a ranch when I was about, I think, 18. So when I turned about 17 and a half or 18, I started galloping at the racetrack. Before that, though, I had broken a 2-year-old with my father at a ranch, and I was getting on a bunch of horses trying to get fit. So when I turned about late 17, you know, 18, he signed for me, and I got all the signatures, and then I got a provisional license. But it was really hard to get the horses, to get the experience, to get those hands, you know, to figure out what you're doing, because people are hesitant to give you a shot on this horse that they maybe spent $20,000, $5,000, $10,000, you know, this phenomenal amount of money on one animal, and I could very well be the one to, you know, ruin that. So people are very hesitant to give you a shot. So I tried galloping horses at Golden Gate Fields for a while, getting on, you know, 3-4 a day. And then someone had told me, you know, you should go to Washington there's a lot of horses out there. You know, they're limited on hands. So I went up to a ranch with Kay Cooper, Jim Penny's daughter. He was a very, very big trainer back in the 80s and whatnot. So I was at the ranch getting on about 10 head a day. And then I told him, you know, I think I'm ready to go to the racetrack. I just feel like, you know, that's my next step and I need to make it. They weren't sure about that. So then one morning I just decided to up and leave. I left, went to the track, got a job with a fellow named Pat Mullins. And after that, I was galloping like eight, nine a day. Every single one was running off. It was hilarious. I mean, not at the time or before, you know, Pat, but he was just such a good old boy. He just told me, don't worry, son, you'll get it.
You did.
And I mean, these things were working like a mile every single day. And I'm surprised they were holding together.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. Not too many people know that. For about 2 months, I got ran off with every horse every day. Like, as we came closer to the end of the 2 months, though, you know, every few weeks, it was like, all right, I'd hold them for about a quarter of a mile. Then I'd finally start holding them for about a half a mile. Then it'd be about three quarters of a mile.
Wow.
Until eventually I could hold them for a mile and a half.
I got to say, Kyle, that makes me feel better when I think back to my early days.
Yeah, exactly.
Knowing that you did that too.
Yeah, see, most people, they're pretty smart, because if you just don't tell people that you have those hard times, they just think you're just phenomenal naturally.
I don't realize.
That people that, you know, learn, just like all of us learn. There's nobody who just naturally gets anything.
Exactly.
You get it quicker than some people, but nobody just automatically knows how to do something. It's realistic. You live and you learn.
That's exactly right. And describe that feeling to our listeners, because it is rather terrifying at moments, I suppose, when you absolutely have no control of your horse and you're exhausted and your horse is...
Oh, yeah, that's terrible, especially when you're light and small, because you're trying to be a race, you're trying to be a jockey, not an exercise boy, you know. I mean, these other guys are like, what, 135, 140, and it's a little easier to play tug of war with the horse when you got that weight on you. I mean, 5 pounds will make a big difference, you know that.
Right, it's true.
So, I mean, man, when you're just sitting back on the horse and they start running, and the only strength that you have left is to just barely turn their head so you don't go running into the back end of a horse, that's a crappy feeling. After a while, you're just like, I can't even steer it anymore. You just pray to God this horse goes straight, and you just throw its head away sometimes. when you're younger, anyways.
You're bringing back memories, Kyle, and not fond ones at that, I have to
say.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's not a good feeling.
I can't really remember the last time I've had a horse run off with me. You know, it's been a while.
Well, thank goodness.
I got dumped. Huh?
Thank goodness you learn along the way how to prevent that from happening. And describe that.
Exactly.
Describe how you work with a horse, how you're working with a 1,200-pound animal, and how you convince that animal to listen to you. How do you do that?
Well, a lot of it's the body language. You know, like me or you, we put off body language, people, animals, things. It's all a body language to everything and everyone. You know, horses, the ears are up forward, pointing, you know, forward. You know, they're in a good mood, they're happy. See them pinned back, you know, they're aggressive and they're upset or whatever it may be. So, and then also the way that they're grabbing the bit. You know that when you have that tension in the reins and they just start dropping their head. It's not like they go from 0 to 100. They start leaning onto it, and you have to feel it happening before it's too late. So then you start, you know, tightening up those reins a little bit, sitting back a little bit more. Maybe you check them one time just so, hey, get off that bit. No, we're not going yet.
Right? When they grab that bit, it's usually over.
Sometimes, unfortunately, when you're learning, you don't have the experience to feel those things happening before it happens. And next thing you know, you're going about a three-quarters of a mile work.
Yes, unfortunately so. And you learned along the way. And before long, you decided it was time to take out your jock's license, and you quit high school early. Is that right?
Yeah, no, I actually quit high school about 16, 17, because I knew I wanted to go to the racetrack. I mean, high school, I tried to do, you know, to do good by it. Freshman year, I had my troubles as a youth in my teens and whatnot. So I thought it was cool to show up and be a jerk, if you will, amongst other things. And then I was like, you know what, I'm sick of being this kind of person. And I tried to go back to junior year of high school, and I didn't have enough credits to be in a regular school, so they told me that they had to send me to a continuation school, which was horrible. And then I walked in that place, and there was barbed wire around these cyclone fences, security guards were holding beating sticks just about. I mean, it was ridiculous. Everybody wore a different color. You weren't allowed to wear colors because of gang banging purposes and what, you know, all that kind of stuff. And of course, you know, I'm one of the few guys raising his hand, trying to learn, trying to do right this year. And this one kid starts, you know, mouthing off to me like, "Oh, you're a dork, you know, you're trying to learn and do it." I was like, "Oh, okay, whatever, man." A month goes by, and then we end up fighting. Then he gets expelled because it was his second fight. Then his little friend decides to fight me again, and yeah, so I got kicked out after like 2 months. It was horrible. It was like a 2-fight limit.
Oh, no. Well,
and I wasn't even trying to do that. It was just something that happened, more of a defense kind of thing.
Hey, again, you obviously did make the right decision in choosing to take out your jockey's license at the time that you did. But tell me, your dad didn't really want you to do that, and he showed you films of horrible accidents trying to convince you otherwise. Is that right?
Yeah. He didn't like it at all, because he had a buddy, Chance Rollins, who actually went down at Golden Gate Fields, died on the racetrack, and then the track doctor, Dr. Dave Seftel, he had revived him. You know, but with a little bit of brain damage and, you know, bodily damage. So, and of course, other riders and whatnot, multiple riders that have been hurt. As you know, it's a very dangerous sport. But he showed me a lot of films, tapes, you know, and I just would kind of chuckle and say, "I still want to do it."
Didn't convince you.
But you get on a racehorse going around that track, all you can imagine is going faster and faster. You know, it's just that need for speed and that timing, that, you know, getting someone right on the wire, you know, nailing someone right on the wire is the best way to win and the worst way to lose.
Yes, you said it. It can be the best feeling in the world. And jockey Kyle Frey is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Kyle, you rode your first race at Golden Gate on November 26, 2010. Tell us what you remember about that very first race.
I felt like I had no clue what was going on, because I did have no clue what was going on. No matter how much I prepared myself for it, there's just something about that adrenaline that just takes over, and you forget everything that you were watching, you listened to, you learned. I mean, for me anyways, I was so eager to do so good that the nerves really got to me. If you watch the first race, it was for someone named Mike Lanzini. He's a good trainer back here at Golden Gate, and I still ride for him even today. He put me on a horse just to get this horse fit. He sent him a mile on the turf. I think it was a mile or a mile 16th on the turf, and that was my first mount. Normally, they won't let an apprentice ride the turf within, like, the first 5 wins or at least 10 mounts, you know.
Right.
But luckily at Golden Gate Fields, they were okay with it, and they went ahead and let me do it. So we hit about the half-mile pole, and I'm just standing up on this horse because he just ran off of me probably a few lengths. I was in front, and then these guys were coming, and I'm like, "Oh, my gosh, what am I supposed to do?" I start chirping my horse, riding him. This horse is dead tired anyways, because I just let him run off about, you know, half a mile. And then I started hitting him a little bit. And then the second mount that I had that day was my father's, Kissing Tristan. And he actually ran good. I think I ran like fourth or third on him or something like that. I think I got the money. That horse, we were coming around the turn, and I was a little more woken up, so I started sending him a little bit. And he's kind of just about running off of me down the lane. He might have won that day if I didn't know what I was doing. And I started hitting him a little bit. But, you know, it's hard to keep those reins in your hand with all that adrenaline going. My irons were way too short because I thought, oh, I'll put my irons up and look really good. And it was just a whole lot of mess, you know. I had to slow down a little bit and figure out what was going on before I went out there trying to look like Gary Gomez.
Do you remember, were you physically exhausted after those first two races?
Yes, I was. That's for sure. I mean, I was tired, but I've seen people get way more tired because I cheated. If you watch my first month of riding, I'm standing straight up. Like, my legs are straight on the backside because I was a vegan at the time. So I wasn't eating meat, chicken, fish. I mean, I was not eating nothing but, like, lettuce and things of that sort. So, I mean, I was able to make the weight and maintain my weight very easily. But, you know, you become anemic. There's no strength to you. That's very, very hard to do considering we are athletes. We need the strength and energy to do our job sufficiently.
So was it after that first race that you decided to go back to eating meat?
Nope. For a little while, I stuck with it. I tried taking certain supplements and things like that and taking B12, which helped a little bit. But then because I had an agent at the time, Ray Harris, very good guy, very good agent. It's Russell Bayes' agent currently, and he has had Russell Bayes' book for a long time, and they've done great together. And he was my first agent, and he's vegan as well. So he taught me how to be vegan just so I could make the weight easily. And then I went to Philadelphia with Mark North. You remember Mark, huh?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, how can you forget him, Mark?
How can you forget Mark North? Come on.
And I went to Philadelphia with Mark North, and he was like, hey, he's like, you need to eat a steak, kid. You're in desperate need of a steak.
That sounds like something Mark would say. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So then I started eating steak, and our business eventually picked up. And, you know, it all takes time. You know, when you have the bug, you're always going to get a shot. It's just a matter of what you do with your horses. And we had a few lucky opportunities, and everything kind of just fell into place. And then Mark, he had this joke. It was terrible. It was hilarious at the same time, but terrible. He'd say, look at that. You started eating steak and you started winning.
Hey, there might be something to that, Kyle. There might be something to that.
Yeah.
Well, we're time for our commercial break here. We'll continue our visit with jockey Kyle Frey after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judges' choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Get ready for the third annual Jockeys and Jeans charity event to benefit the PDJF coming to Gulfstream Park on Sunday, February 28th. Last year, Jockeys and Jeans raised more than $200,000 to benefit permanently disabled riders, and you can help make this year's event even bigger. Meet and mingle with an all-star cast of jockeys, including Lafitte Ping Kai Jr., Georgie Velasquez, Pat Day, Randy Romero, and many more. Tickets go on sale at the beginning of January, and donations and sponsorship can be purchased starting December 7th. For more information, visit jockeysandjeans.com. Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Pena, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much. is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm Christina McManigal here, joined tonight by jockey Kyle Frey. Kyle, before we went to the break, you mentioned when you traveled from California to Parks in Pennsylvania. Now, what was that transition like, given that you grew up in California, and I'm assuming that was probably the biggest move you'd ever made in your life, clear across the country. What was that transition like?
At first, it was nerve-wracking to get the courage up to actually go, because Mark North had been bugging me for a couple of days. He said, "Hey, kid, you know, if you come with me out here, I swear we could probably get the Eclipse Award." He said it from day one. He said, "You know, we'll do really good. Trust me. Let's just get out of here. Go. You're not gonna make that much money here. You know, the purses over there are ridiculous." And he pumped it up. He really, without him, I wouldn't have made a move anywhere, and I probably would not have gotten the Eclipse Award. And result, he really pushed me, telling me, you know, this place will be here. If we don't do good over there, you can always come back. Don't worry about it. And sure enough, after a while, I decided to just, you know, pick up my sack and get out. And it was very nerve-wracking, you know, but at the same time, very exciting. Once we got there, I only had probably, I want to say, like $800 to last me.
Wow.
After plane ticket and all, I had about $800. Either make it or go home.
Pressure's on.
And, as soon as we got there, though, Mark's friend, you know John McCaslin.
Yes.
Old cowboy. he put us on a horse. Horse won. Then after that, everyone was a little less hesitant to use us. So we started, you know, picking up slowly, and sure enough, we were making at least some kind of money every week. So I ended up not having to go home, and eventually it just picked up, and Ramon Preciado started riding us, and he's just a phenomenal trainer. I mean, he just gets them right. All those guys are out there. You got his brother, Lupe, Butch Reed, Mike Pino. I mean, there's a bunch of great trainers there. And, you know, my apologies if any of them are listening and I forgot to mention one of their names.
What was the difference between riding in California and Pennsylvania as far as the riders and their style? What was the biggest difference?
Well, you know, before I even say anything about style, the biggest difference for me was the fact that I started on a Tapeta racetrack, meaning there is no kickback. You can go around there with one goggle on your helmet, and you don't even have to pull it down.
Wow.
You know, being in Parks, you have to have about three or four goggles going a mile because you are going to get pelted.
There's a lot of kickback at Parks, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't even think about that.
That right there for me was the biggest change. No, the style-wise, you know, guys there are a little more eager to move. Depending on the day, on how the track plays, is really – you know, what the better riders will change up their styles. And that's one thing I learned, you know, from Kendrick Carmuth, Stuart Elliott, Frankie Pennington, you know, all those guys, is, you know, read the track, how it's playing, because a dirt track is going to play different almost every day, you know, depending on if it rains, if it was moist the night before, you know, all that kind of stuff, how much they work to the track. So that was something that really helped me. And but as far as all goes, there's a lot of guys out there with a lot of different styles. Just like anywhere you go, you have some guys that ride real short, some guys that ride long. But majority of the time, you want to try and imitate the styles of the guys that are, you know, you can barely put air in between their butt and the saddle, and their elbows are in, their heads down, buried, and they're just pumping away. Like Stuart Elliott, amazing style, great rider. Kendrick Carmuth, amazing. I mean, there's a lot of good riders in there. There's a handful that I particularly, you know, respect, because they helped me a lot coming up.
Great guys in the jocks room at Parks, Kyle. And how would you describe your own style?
My style.
Yes.
I've been told, you know, I look like a few different guys, but it all depends on how my back's doing and my leg. You know, I take Advil now. I've got it pretty well figured out, so I've been pretty consistent. But on a dying horse, I would say my style is horrible. On a running horse, hey, let's go to the Breeders' Cup.
Hey, that's, I think, true with every rider. It's much easier to ride a horse that's running for you, of course.
Yes, exactly.
Now,
I think the stride is a lot smoother. They're just moving outwards instead of when they're tired, when they're just kind of plotting up and down and up and down, just trying to make it to the wire.
That's exactly right. Now, Kyle, I actually had jockey Anthony Black on the show here a couple weeks ago. Do you remember riding with him at Parks?
Oh, yeah. Tony's a man. Oh, he's a great guy. Actually, I have a funny story. Not to interrupt whatever you're going to say, but I have a hilarious story. Before I came out to Philadelphia, there was someone who was a safety steward here at Golden Gate Field. His name's Paul Nicolo. And he rode in Chicago, Philadelphia, you know, Pennsylvania, all that circuit. And he had told me, he said, if you happen to ride with a fellow named Tony Black, he said, do not go inside of him. He said, no matter how much horse you have, don't go inside of him. You will not make it.
Good advice.
So what was that?
Good advice. Very good advice.
Yeah, you know, too. Yeah, no, Tony, he's an aggressive rider. He knows where you are before you know where you are.
He rides his horse and every other horse in the field as well. You're exactly right.
Yeah, exactly. He's a phenomenal rider. I mean, very seasoned. But, you know, after he had told me that, it was my mission to beat Tony on the inside, which I actually did accomplish with, I think it was a 4 or 5 horse head-to-head finish. It was like me, Tony second by a head, and someone else third by a head, fourth by a head, and fifth by a head. There's like 4 or 5 horses just head-to-head coming down the wire, and you see my head just pop out, and it was awesome, man. I was like a huge pump up in my career. I only beat him one time, but it was an exciting win. And the other time, though, he had me beat.
That is quite the accomplishment, I have to say. I can't remember ever beating Tony on the inside at the wire, so... Kudos to you,
and,
I have
and
to
honestly,
say.
Honestly, I can't lie, though, because my horse was lugging out, and he knew that if he'd come over on me and tighten me up, that I would have eventually had to grab my horse, went on the heels with him, and been in trouble. So I kind of got away with a little bit of sympathy.
Hey, that's Tony. He's a great guy. He would never put anyone in a bad spot, but he was...
Exactly. And he knew. He was like, this dumb bug, boy, he just ran up in there with the horses lugging on.
Wow. Tony Black. Now, Kyle, you obviously did so well at Parks. It was the right decision to make the move there. And in 2011, you were up for the Eclipse Awards. Now, there was some controversy surrounding the statistics, and it actually had to do with another jockey at Parks, Rosario Montanez, who you rode with. There had to be a recount for the Apprentice Award. What was that like to go through that and to see him every day and know he was your competition and all the drama surrounding that?
Oh, man, that was big. I don't know if you remember. I sure do. I mean, it was just little immature, you know, apprentice attitude, though. Nowadays, I don't try to, you know, buy into all that conflict and stuff. You know, let someone else ride their race and I'll ride mine. But he's a good guy. I think we just got off on the wrong foot because I came there and, you know, I'm sure he was nervous with another bug showing up over at Parks. I think you had just gotten hurt before that, so you weren't riding. So I was the new bug coming in, and he was supposed to be second to take over, you know, your business and whoever else, you know. So I'm sure he was a little upset about that. So there was just a little bit of conflict between us surrounding it. But, no, we both did great. Even with two bugs being there, we both did great. I mean, we had our own business. I don't think we rode for too many of the same people. But, yeah, no, he did great. He's a good rider. I did my thing. He did his thing. There was a little bit of conflict along the way, but it's all in the past. As far as the recount goes, though, Somehow, I don't know how, but they had kept counting his wins after he had lost the bug and his purse money and percentage and all that, which, you know, for the Eclipse Award statistics, it is from when you start the bug to when you finish. If you start the 1st of January or you know, any time in between that, it's just that year, basically, that you have the bug. So say a guy starts, you know, the middle of 2011, and then he finishes bug the middle of 2012, then he can only count those 6 months of that year, that, you know, towards the second half. He can only count that 6 months. You can't count the year before 6 months. It's just, you know, when you had the bug for that year. So they kept counting his wins after he lost the apprenticeship, and then they turned in those statistics, which it looked great because he had, I think, like 20 more wins or something, like 15 more wins, you know, because he had the bug before I had gotten there, and he was already winning races, and I had just gotten there like two or three months after the year had started. And so I took me a little while to get going, but he had lost his bug and still won a few races here and there at that time. And yeah, so there was Paul's statistics turned in, and, you know, I felt cheated. I wasn't going to fight about it too much. I was really upset, but I didn't do much. I wasn't going to do much about it. But my agent was very frustrated because he knows that we worked so hard to do what we did. And so he called a few people, tried to see what he could get done about it. And sure enough, they declared that they'd have to have a revote. Oh, actually, I forgot the part that a friend of my agent's, Frank Miramati, he had noticed. He was like, "Hey, Mark, are you sure?" "Oh, no, no, nope." I'm wrong again. It was not Frank Miramati. It was a fellow named Tom who worked in the newsroom at Golden Gate Fields. He noticed it. And he called Mark and said, "Hey, are you sure about those statistics that you were telling me about, you know, what your stats were and whatnot?" He's like, "Yeah." "Why?" "Well, I just got this sheet for the voting ballot, and it seems like you're wrong. The other kid has a lot more than you." And so they looked into it, and, you know, they found out that they were still counting his wins after he lost the button. And so that's where that went.
Wow.
After that, we kind of blew that up. And, yeah, they ended up having me first revote for Apprentice Rider of the Year.
You made history, Kyle.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, not in the way.
Away, though, like in a crybaby fashion, like, "Hey, I won my award."
No, it was fair after the recount, and the results were in, and you were declared the winner of the 2011 Eclipse Award for Outstanding Apprentice. When you went to receive your award, Kyle, you gave an acceptance speech, and unfortunately your grandfather had just passed away. Describe to us in a brief amount of time what you said in that acceptance speech.
That was a bummer, because the whole time I was winning all the races, towards the end of the bug, I was just excited because I was going to be able to, you know, feel good, feel like I was on the right path, and that I could make my whole family proud and my grandfather as well, because I looked up to him a lot as a rider and even as a person. So yeah, that was a bummer. I kind of felt like me and him both got cheated, but I'm sure he saw all of it somewhere, you know.
I'm sure he did, and he was very proud.
It kind of upsets me even thinking about it. It's a shame. I really wish he could have been there, or at least watched it on TV, you know.
Well, I'm sure he would have been very, very proud, Kyle. And you continued riding at Parks and unfortunately had a streak of bad luck. You went down in a spill in 2012 and had a terrible, terrible fracture to your right femur. Describe to us what happened there.
Oh, yeah, that was a very, very unfortunate event. So I think I was sitting, I was on the lead, either on the lead or sitting second on the inside of a horse. And I remember I started making my move at the head of the stretch. I started a little bit early, too, because my horse was starting to get headed, and he was starting to just kind of quit. So I start sending this horse. I'm pumping, whipping. We get to head a stretch where we're going to switch leads, and he's kind of switched over. Either he stepped on his hoof or he crossed his legs. I can't remember exactly what it was, but then he had bobbled, kind of went halfway down. I grabbed him. He took about two steps, and then he just went straight down and threw me down like a slingshot. And then a horse was kind of like about two lengths behind me. I believe Alex Sinkron was on it, and he had his head down. He was buried riding, so he didn't see it until it was way too late. He just went clear over my horse, and he got catapulted as well. But his horse basically landed straight on my femur, his knees. I believe it was his knees landed on my femur. I've watched the replay 100 times trying to figure out how I broke it, and that's kind of the conclusion I came to. The horse kind of landed on my femur, and that's how that just popped like a toothpick, man.
Kyle, you mentioned watching the replay, and I experienced the same when I had my injuries, and whenever I would come to in the hospital, the first thing I would want to see was the replay so I could understand what had happened, given that when you're knocked unconscious, half the time you don't really know why you got there. So tell us why you wanted to watch the replay, and was it traumatizing at all to see that?
Oh, no. I mean, I knew what happened for the most part. It was kind of funny because I was conscious on the track with the broken femur. I even popped my head up and looked over at Ramon Preciado because we were supposed to go do the ski runners over in, what was that, New Jersey, Seaside Heights.
Yes.
We were supposed to go ride those ski runners, the jet ski kind of things. And I looked over and I was like, hey, Ramon, I don't think I'm going tomorrow. He started laughing. He said, you're sick.
Wow.
I mean, I was still cracking jokes and whatnot, but I was in an immense amount of pain. And, when we went to after I passed out again because of all the painkillers and we got to the hospital, I kept watching the replay just to see, did the horse break his leg or did he grab his shoe or, you know, what went wrong, you know? I was just like, man, how could this happen right now? It was just more of a, you know, something you just got to figure it out so you can kind of feel like you have the ability to prevent it next time. You know how that goes. You want to learn. You want to learn how to prevent accidents and then how to encourage ones.
Of course. And you actually had to have a rod and 4 screws inserted into that leg. Is that right?
Yes, you are correct.
That sounds quite terrible, Kyle. And thank goodness you're doing okay. How long were you out for?
I don't think I was out for that long. I think it ended up being like 3 months when the doctors told me it'd be about 6 to 9 months. I'm not too big on following the rules, as you can tell. So when they told me I'd be out for like 6 to 9 months, I looked at my agent and my friend at the time, like, yeah, that's not happening. So yeah, waited for my leg to heal up a little bit, started walking on it, putting weight on it. Kind of helped push the bone back together, built it a little bit faster. I tried to stay, you know, moving my leg even when it was broken, try to get fluid, in, you know, blood circulating to it. Then I just started working out a little bit early after I could kind of walk a little bit, slightly jog. I just decided to go ahead and jump on horses. I'll tell you what, the first couple of weeks, it was nasty. Because all I could hear was crunch, snap, crack, and pop. Those weak legs, those joints are just pounding together. It's just bone on bone without any muscle. So it was kind of nasty the first month. But then the muscle came back, and I tightened up real quick. My weight was amazing. I was like 110, 111. So it was good, and I started doing really good over at Golden Gate.
You were only focused on getting back to the saddle, and jockey Kyle Frey joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Kyle, you had that injury. You left Parks. You recovered, and you began riding at Golden Gate.
Yes, the place that I the place where it had all started.
Back to where it all began, and that is where you are still currently riding, yes?
Yes, I am still currently riding here.
Now,
having a lot of fun doing it.
Hey. Now, during that recovery time, you also dealt with a few personal issues, and that's understandable given that I know myself, when you're injured and you can't ride, you get very frustrated and depressed given that riding is what you love, and when you can't do it, it takes a toll on your mentality. You get depressed, basically. So yeah, tell us about those personal issues you had to deal with.
Well, you know, there was a lot of at first it was more to party and have fun. You know, I started, you know, drinking, but I wasn't too much of a drinker. So and then I started smoking pot, which, you know, that was my thing at the time. And from there, I started hanging out with people. Because when I was a teenager, you know, I experimented. I had my share of, you know, trying this or that. But I wasn't too heavy into anything. Like, I wasn't a drug addict at that point in my life. Because as soon as I came to the track, I stopped doing all that stuff. But once I got hurt, it was like, oh, you know what? I can go ahead and, you know, have some fun again. At least I'm not going to get drug tested. No one's going to know. I'm not putting anyone's lives in danger. Because I'm not going to be on a horse or driving a vehicle or nothing like that. So then I started smoking pot. And then from there, it led to cocaine and other stuff. You know, it wasn't an everyday kind of thing. It was just occasional. But as you get thrown deeper into all that depressive state, it kind of becomes habit. And then I came back to riding. I had to be sober for riding because I was going to get drug tested. But since I was now a dependent on this crutch of, you know, drugs, I then found out about Spice, which is synthetic marijuana, basically, and is unable to test. It was unable to be tested for at that time, and no one was testing for it. So I kind of had the perfect setup to fail, basically. Because I could go ahead and smoke this stuff before the races, after the races. I mean, I didn't start smoking before the races until about the end, you know. And it was like I had to have it in my system or else I just did not feel right. Like I couldn't ride right. Kind of crazy to say. But there was a point that I thought if I quit, I'd probably stop winning races. Just because it was like the only thing that would pick you back up. And towards the end, I was doing a lot of, you know, cocaine, too, and it was just a lot of bad stuff. When I came back after my injury, I was doing good. And then I tried to go back to Philadelphia, and I didn't do so good for whatever reason being. So I came back home, and, you know, I was upset. You know, I felt like, you know, I just went from an all-time high in my career from getting the Outstanding Eclipse Award Apprentice of the Year to now I'm riding 30-1 shots. 40-1 shots, you know, every race, and it was just very upsetting and frustrating. I felt like I deserved more, which, you know, is a false sense of entitlement, because, you know, everyone goes through their ups and downs. What was to make me so special or better than anyone else? It was kind of a bad outlook on stuff. You kind of get spoiled winning all those races. You forget how hard you had to work to get there and how hard everyone else works just to be able to ride a horse in a race, whether it be 30-1 or dead favorite, you know. Sometimes you forget that stuff. So, yeah, I started getting real depressed, and I had, you know, other issues in my life, little personal issues and whatnot, with family and friends and such. So it was just kind of like a downward spiral that I went into. I blew about $500,000 that year and just, you know, buying clothes and thinking I was awesome. I'm thinking the money would never stop coming in. I mean, you get such a warped outlook on what reality is, you know, from reality to what you think life is. It's just, it's crazy. Sorry, I'm kind of so coughing. But yeah, no, and then I started going deeper and deeper, and I ended up getting caught. They drug tested me at Golden Gate Fields, and they searched my car, which they had found the bottle of Spice, which is like basically potpourri with chemicals on it, so it's the same kind of high as weed, but it just doesn't test. But they had a test for it. They just needed the bottle to know what to search for. So they got the bottle. It said what drugs were on it, or, you know, what chemicals. And then that's how they got me with the positive. And from there, you know, I was already very willing to go to rehab because I was so depressed and so miserable with living my life the way that I was. You know, a couple weeks before they had actually busted me, I looked into a Kaiser outpatient program, but I just didn't have the courage to really, you know, call and set up an appointment. So the stewards, they could tell that I was very willing to you know, get past this point in my life and, you know, do what I can to make it better. So they gave me the opportunity, and sure enough, I went to rehab at an outpatient program. So it was like the equivalent of 3 months of rehab altogether, and it was probably the best thing I ever did in my life. Because now, I mean, we just bought a ranch, me and my current fiance, and we'll be getting married March 5th. So, I mean, yeah, my life has definitely took a complete 180 from horrible to amazing, and I am a very blessed man for all this.
That is so great to hear, Kyle. Your life is looking good, and you are engaged with a house. That is just fantastic news. I saw pictures on Facebook. You're building a fence.
Yeah, that thing, I don't know if it can hold a fly in, but it sure does look good.
Hey, long as it looks good, Kyle. We're almost out of time here, but tell us what you do in your free time.
Well, right now, like I said, you know, we just bought this house, so, I mean, I'm just having so much fun just coming to this 2.5-acre home that I now have, getting it ready for the horses that we're going to bring in when we completely move in here. So I'm getting these fences ready. We have two little overhang, like, roofs that we're going to raise up, turn into a 4-stall barn. I mean, there's just so many fun projects that I have here, and I've always been real big on working with my hands other than working with horses. So being here and having a shot to, you know, learn how to do different things.
Kyle, we're all out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you, Christina.
Join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock for another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm Christina McManigal. Thanks for listening.